Last night, Senator Mark Kirk and Representative Tammy Duckworth met in a televised debate, and a racially charged statement by Kirk about Duckworth's family is today creating national headlines. We'll find out more. It's a big night for Chicago Cubs fans. The World Series comes to Wrigley Field for the first time in 71 years. We'll talk with Crane Chicago Business's Danny Ecker about who's cashing in. Also, Illinois is home to some of the most haunted places in the Midwest, but what makes a place haunted?
All of these places where history has happened, where it's left a mark or an imprint, like a devastating event, like the battlefields of Gettysburg, for instance. I think that history has stayed behind these places, and I think that that's what we really think of many times as a haunting.
And Chicago musician Justin Roberts joins us to talk about his new kids album titled Lemonade. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. For tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got lots going on this Friday. We've got the Chicago Cubs, their first World Series game since 71 years, since 1945, right? We're also going to be talking about Senator Kirk and Tammy Duckworth's debate yesterday evening. Some racially charged statements by Senator Kirk making national headlines today. The reporter who asked those questions, Shorta Abadea, is going to be joining us. But first, let's go to Chicago and to Wrigley Field. If you want a ticket for one of this weekend's World Series games, you better be ready to dig deep into your wallet. If the Cubs win tonight and tomorrow night, that sets up a possible World Series clinching game on Sunday night. Their first in 108 years, tickets for the game are going for an average of $3,550. That's according to yesterday evening's last time we checked on prices. We're joined now by Danny Ecker. He covers the business of Chicago sports for Crane Chicago Business. He's on the line with us from Chicago. Hey, Danny, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I saw some pictures on Twitter of bars already full at 7:30 this morning in Chicago. What's the atmosphere like? Has everybody taken the day off? Is everybody at the bar?
I think people are just very impatiently counting down the minutes, the hours here until they can get out and go, you know, watch this thing. It's must-see TV. Some of the Mike and Mike, the ESPN national radio show, is broadcasting from the Cubby Bear this morning at 5 a.m., so that's why there was a crowd out there. I think a lot of people who live in Wrigleyville might have been woken up by the news choppers flying overhead at 5 a.m., so it's about as big as it gets of a sports day here in the city.
And so not only the bars full, we've seen bars charging an incredible amount just to get in to watch the game on TV. How high of cover charges are you seeing in Wrigleyville right now?
You know, I think some of the cover charges to get in, I think I saw was as high as $300. You know, there were a lot that were $100, $200. I mean, these are ones that are right by the stadium. And then there are some that are a lot lower than that. There's a lot of really expensive bar packages that a lot of these bars are promoting. But, you know, really what we saw for the Game 6 clincher in the NLCS was lines that were 70, 80, 100 people long, and that was an hour before the game, and people, you know, there weren't any covers, but people were just waiting in line for some reason to get in because they weren't going to get in. So I think this is kind of one of those ways that the bars, at least on Clark Street near the stadium, are trying to capitalize on this, and rightfully so. I mean, this is about as hot as it gets, and, you know, with demand this high, you know, you're able to make a bunch of money on it.
Mm-hmm. What are brands like Miller Lite doing to win over Cubs fans? I imagine this is also a great brand opportunity for a lot of companies.
Well, right. And so Miller's a really interesting case. So Miller, if you didn't know any better, you would think that Miller has some sort of partnership with the Cubs. They don't at all. The Cubs have a giant Budweiser sign in right field, as many people know, and they're a really, really high-paying sponsor of the team. But Miller has done an interesting job all around the city this month with his campaign that you know, uses, you know, wording like it's our year, history starts now. There's images of bricks and ivy and a generic baseball player. You know, you can't help but make the connection with the Cubs, but there's no mention of Cubs or the blue W or any of the, you know, Cubs trademarks. And so it's kind of one of those interesting ways that you see companies that are not affiliated with the team in any official way try to get some splash of the goodwill, so to speak. and make sure that they're part of this party as well. So it kind of actually makes a challenge. I mean, that's on a big level, and then there's a challenge for those like Budweiser and other official team partners that, you know, pay six, seven figures a year for the right to use the Cubs trademarks in their promotions, and they're the ones that it's really on them to try to make sure that it's kind of unequivocal in the market that we are the official partners and we get to act like it.
So everybody's making money off of this, right, Danny? So we're not talking about the brands, the bars. What about all the people in the neighborhood? We were looking this morning on Airbnb. I saw a private room down the street from Wrigley, someone renting a room for $750 a night. How much are people and from kind of just the standard Wrigleyville resident, how much are they cashing in on this too? I guess maybe even all across the city, right, Danny?
Yeah. Well, and especially, I mean, it's funny when you talk about the economic impact of this whole thing, it really is so much more focused on the north side than it is, you know, at hotels around the city. I mean, this is such a, you know, for residents in the area, you know, the parking prices, if they want to rent out their spots over the next, you know, couple nights are exorbitant. You know, they're two, maybe even three times as much as they would get during the regular season.
So what is that, about $75 then for a space?
Yeah,
right?
Something in that range. And, you know, and you've got, you know, maybe adding to that is the fact that the city is shutting down so many of the streets around Wrigley to parking. So, you know, it even limits the parking options even further, although you kind of have to be a little nuts to drive to anywhere near Wrigley Field over the next three nights. So, you know, there's the parking aspect and then the Airbnb. I mean, it's kind of one of those ways that because there's this dearth of hotels in the area, which the Cubs are trying to change now since they're building their own across the street from the ballpark, a lot of these residents are able to put their places on Airbnb. The company said that they saw a pretty substantial increase in just the number of new listings in the area over the past, you know, from this month compared to last month. People just trying to see what they can get, and obviously they're getting some really high prices.
And Danny, I wonder then also just bigger sort of the merchandise story for the team in terms of how much money they can make. I don't know how much merchandise sales will be a cut going back to the Cubs versus the MLB. I was in Chicago this weekend and I was at one of the stores on Michigan Avenue around 10 o'clock when they opened, just kind of one of the big Cubs stores right before Millennium Park. And people were kind of just like running in going, where are the shirts? And everybody wanted to buy. And I mean, that's even, we have stories of that happening. People outside Dick's Sporting Goods in Champaign across the state as soon as they opened on Sunday with people wanting to buy World Series gear. How much is that going to have an impact? Do you think is that going to be significant enough that the Cubs are going to notice that revenue?
Yeah, it's absolutely a really nice piece of revenue for the team. You know, the Blackhawks have enjoyed this obviously in the last few years where people just you know, going nuts to try to get their hands on any sort of merch they can get. It's a near-term spike, I would say, for the team. You know, in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of one of those things that they get for a month or so where there's a unlimited almost demand for anything that has to do with the Cubs and World Series, especially given how historic this is. But you know, the merchandise, it really pales in comparison to the value that the Cubs get from competing in a World Series and obviously potentially winning a World Series over the long term when it comes to sort of this validation of their brand, that, you know, brands that want to be associated with a team that has won a championship have to pay premium rates. And the Cubs, I mean, the funny thing is that they've been selling, you know, this storyline for a while, and that has helped in merchandise sales too. I mean, you look at the most popular jerseys at the official MLB shop all season long were Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo, and Jake Arrieta was up there. I mean, this is something that the Cubs have really been capitalizing on for most of this year, and now it's kind of reaching a fever pitch for the team where you've got people that maybe were casual fans that want to be on the bandwagon, and they're willing to pay a lot of money to get a jersey or a shirt or, you know, to put their, you know, put clothes on their dog that are Cubs, you know, Cubs related.
I've seen a lot of those too. Oh, well, thanks for joining us. Danny Ecker covers the business of Chicago sports for Crane Chicago Business. We'll tweet out more of Danny's stories on this if you follow us at 21ST Show. Thanks, Danny.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking about the Cubs and playing Cubs theme music all week. We wanted to take a listen to Eddie Vedder's song Go All the Way, headed into tonight's game. Maybe this weekend they will.
Heroes in blue, give us the chance to feel like heroes too. Forever will
should lose. We know someday we'll go all the way. Yeah, someday we'll go all the way.
You're listening to The 21st. Last night, Senator Mark Kirk met his opponent, Representative Tammy Duckworth, in their second televised debate. And one moment from that debate, Kirk's racially charged statements about Duckworth's family has since created a national news story and calls for him to apologize. Let's hear the full context of what happened last night.
You know, my family has served this nation in uniform going back to the Revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But I still want to be there in the Senate when the drums of war sound, because people are quick to sound the drums of war. And I want to be there to say, this is what it costs. This is what you're asking us to do. And if that's the case, I'll go. Families like mine are the ones that bleed first. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in. And let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Senator Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Move on to the next question. This is Bernie Schoenberg.
What most haven't heard is that Duckworth did respond to that statement that Kirk made after, as you heard, that very awkward silence. Here's what she said.
There's been members of my family serving in uniform on my father's side going back to the Revolution. I belong to the William J. Penny chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution. I'm proud of both my father's side and my mother, who's an immigrant.
That audio, courtesy of WICS News Channel 20's Jordan Abadea, the reporter who asked the question Duckworth was answering when all of this happened. She joins us now from their newsroom in Springfield. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for providing that audio, because I think it gives some context we're really not seeing in these national stories, because we see that she was able to respond. And I wonder, can you take us back to the question Representative Duckworth was actually answering? You asked this question when it all happened.
Sure. So before my question, we had asked a few about the threat of ISIS. But being from the Middle East myself and knowing personally the conflicts over there, it's not just ISIS that the United States is facing. It is a plethora of different groups and different factions and different tribes. So I had asked both the senator and the congresswoman what their plans were for long-term involvement in the Middle East, whether they think that is something we should get out of completely, or if that is something that we need to further invest in and continue for years to come. Obviously, after our two wars in the Middle East, just leaving the Middle East would be very difficult. So I wanted to know what they would support in terms of a long-term plan. And so that's the question that Congresswoman Duckworth was answering and Senator Kirk.
And what was the reaction of the room when Senator Kirk made that statement?
So throughout the debate, we had had rules in place where they couldn't cheer and they couldn't talk. But, of course, when you have, you know, over 200 people in the room, as we did that night, it's very difficult to enforce those rules. And so throughout the debate, we had heard some cheering. We had tried to calm it down. We'd heard whispers or people chattering. When that moment happened, it was complete silence. And I think all of us did not expect that, and it's not something you expect on stage. And so it was just an awkward about 10 seconds of silence that felt very long. Once our moderator, Adam Reif, then went on to the next question, Bernie Schoenberg from the SJR offered Congresswoman Duckworth a few 30 seconds to just respond to that, because it wasn't written in our rules for her to have that response, and she had answered first, that sort of thing. So she had had a quick 30 seconds to respond to his comments, and then we had moved on.
Mm-hmm. Now, and just to be clear, as she said there and she said after the debate, she said it then and she said it afterwards again, that she's just as proud of her Thai mother as she is of her father's family, whose ancestors did fight in the American Revolution. The social media last night was all abuzz with this. I was really surprised to see how much this was becoming not just Illinois folks talking about this, but a national story. What reaction have you seen throughout, both from the Democratic Party as well as from everyone else this morning?
Yeah, so I didn't get home about till 10:15 last night, and I had just turned on Twitter after the debate. And frankly, that happened very early in the debate. That was before our first break. And so by the time it was over, many of us had thought it was an awkward encounter, but we had moved on because there were a few of them throughout the debate. And so, you know, I just turned Twitter on and I scrolled and I started to see, I think it was The Atlantic first and then The Guardian and then CNN and NBC Nightly News and ABC World News, and all of these people were picking up the story, you know, and then And the Kirk campaign had to send out a response. And so their response was that, you know, Senator Kirk has consistently called Duckworth and her family a war hero and honors her family's service to this country. But then they said, you know, that's not what this debate was about. Representative Duckworth lied about her legal troubles and was unable to defend her failures at the VA and then falsely attacked Senator Kirk over his record on supporting gay rights. So a lot of people looked at that statement that came out last night after this started blowing up and said, wow, that's not even something close to an apology
right.
that many people had expected.
Right. And we've seen lots of people, Democratic Party, saying this is racist. He needs to apologize. We haven't heard that yet. Jordan, we just have about a minute and a half, but I just want to go back. You said there were other awkward moments in the evening. Are there others that stood out to you that maybe others that people have missed?
Yeah, there wasn't the outright, you know, racism that many are seeing in this moment, but there was just some awkward moments. I think some that happened with a debate. There were some awkward pauses. You know, Senator Kirk didn't really use all of his time to respond, so a couple times the moderator had cut him off, and I think he needed to pause for a second and complete his thoughts. So it was just there were some other awkward points throughout the night. Nothing. Of this magnitude. But by the time it was all over after 90 minutes, I mean, we had touched on a wide range of issues. And so this one had kind of, by the time, you know, the moderator and the panelists were all done and we were saying, oh, that was a good debate. This one had slipped our minds until we had looked on social media and saw that it had blown up.
Jordan, 10-second answer, if you can. How do you think this is going to affect the outcome of the race?
This is going to be very bad for Senator Kirk unless they get ahead of this and tamp down some of this, because even this morning it's still continuing.
WICS's News Channel 20's political reporter Jordan Abadea, who was at yesterday evening's debate. Jordan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's Halloween soon, so we thought we would talk ghost stories for a minute, or to be more specific, Illinois haunted place stories. We're joined on the line by authors Colin Dickey and Troy Taylor, who both written about haunted places in Illinois and other states around the country. Colin's new book is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. He joins us from his book tour. Troy has written a handful of books on haunted places in Illinois, including Haunted Illinois Ghosts and Strange Phenomena of the Prairie State. Troy's on the line with us from Jacksonville. Colin, Troy, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us on.
Troy, let's start with you. You started getting interested in ghost stories at a pretty young age. What initially sparked your interest?
Actually, it was a record. a record on the back of a honeycomb cereal box. When I was about 10 years old, they put out ghost stories one year, and you could cut it off and play it on your record player. And I had three different stories, but the one that really stuck with me was the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, which I played over and over again in my parents' basement until it wore out, which didn't take much because it was the back of a cardboard
box.
It did stick with me, and I think that that's just kind of what kicked off my interest in, you know, ghosts and all kinds of strange things, and that's all I've ever done my whole life. So I guess that record started all of it for me.
And as it turns out, that record and that story about the Vanishing Hitchhiker, I know that's really, some would say, eerily similar to one of your favorite ghost stories in Illinois, the Resurrection Mary story. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, the Resurrection Mary story, you know, what makes it so unique is that it's not just a resurrection or just a Vanishing Hitchhiker story. Because her legend is really been created from real places and real events and real people. Not only was she a real person, actually two young women, but she was encountered by real people, including a number who, you know, to the day they died, swear that they spent the entire night with her. I mean, the basic story is that she is a young woman who hitches rides on Archer Avenue on the southwest side of Chicago, trying to get to the Willowbrook, or from the Willowbrook Ballroom, which was a dance hall, to Resurrection Cemetery. And people who have had her in the car claim that she disappears at the gates. And there have been, wow, I mean, maybe 100 or more people who claim they've encountered her. Some of them are really convincing. A man named Jerry Palis, I interviewed before he passed away in the early 90s, and he swore to me that one night in the in the late 40s, he had picked her up and had given her a ride. She'd gotten out of the car, ran across the road, and vanished at the cemetery gate. So, you know, it's a classic vanishing hitchhiker story, but it's just one of those stories that really grabbed my attention at a young age, and I've always been fascinated with it.
So, Colin, your book is called Ghostland, American History in Haunted Places. And I have to ask, how does Illinois rank in terms of when you look across the country and all of the places you covered? Where are we in terms of how many haunted places we have, according to your research?
Illinois turns out to be pretty good. You know, I wanted to kind of sample, you know, ghost stories and kind of, in some cases, the true stories behind them, you know, all around the country. And sure enough, you find a lot of great stuff in the South in particular. You find a lot of stuff in New England. But Illinois is doing just well. I mean, I think there are some really great stories that are associated in and around Chicago, particularly amongst its cemeteries, and then stories, you know, related to the 1893 fire, of course, and also out in sort of, you know, farther places. One of the places I looked at was a house in Bull Valley, Illinois, which is pretty far out there, but it is famous for supposedly being haunted and being built by spiritualists out there.
Right, and that's in northern Illinois. And your book is about how you analyze how they were created through the years. Can you tell us about how that story actually started? Because in your book, you talk about a design flaw that was in the house.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really curious and beautiful house. It's now, I think, being used by the sheriff, but it doesn't. The walls or the corners are rounded, so it's built to sort of look like a sort of rounded Italian villa. And you know, and the guy who designed it, I think, just designed it that way aesthetically. But over the years, it got associated with another idea that the sort of folklore idea that the devil will catch you in corners. And so if you want to keep away from the devil, the way to do it would be to build round rooms and round houses. And so over time, these two, you know, stories kind of merged, and the idea evolved that this house was actually built to keep away the spirits from catching the builder of this house. And, you know, and mysteriously, he finally was found dead in the one corner in the entire house, which is kind of fictitious, but, you know, kind of suggest the way that sometimes a strange or unusual building will kind of gather up ghost stories to it in unusual and surprising ways.
Is it, Colin, is it sometimes strange to learn the actual history of how these stories started?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, I started, looking at these places, sort of assuming that the stories were true, and you know, and it was kind of a bummer in some cases to learn how they had been sort of fabricated over the years. But I think what I try to do in the book as a whole, and what I ultimately found even more fascinating, is trying to figure out how these stories evolved over the years, why some stories get told and retold more than others, and what maybe that says about us, you know, psychologically and culturally, that we favor certain kind of stories over others.
Troy, what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking back to your hitchhiker story, and you're telling me about all of the people, hundreds of people who, in this case, 100 people who saw this same woman. What's it like to talk to someone who's so convinced that they've experienced something like this?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I can think has kept me interested in this for the last 25 years or so, is because I've talked to so many people who have such a fascination. And one of the things, and I'm going to throw this in there, because I really liked Colin's book, it's very good. And one of the things that I've noticed about it and loved about it was the fact that these stories do get started for, you know, and change and merge into other things often, but oftentimes they do get started for a very good reason. The story may change and twist and turn over the years, but I think a lot of times, at least in some of the research I've done, that people who have encountered something are so convinced by what it was that, you know, they don't want to let it go. I mean, we don't know why people are so fascinated with ghosts. I mean, I think the question can be answered in as simple a way as people love scary things, and in as complicated a way as, well, I want to see what's waiting for me on the other side. Is this proof of life after death? And I think that's what keeps a lot of belief for a lot of people, is that they're sure they encountered something, and maybe it was, you know, the ghost of Resurrection Mary, or maybe it was something else entirely, but they're so convinced and so deepen their beliefs because we're all wanting to know what comes next.
It's so interesting that you say that. Right before we came on the air, I was reading, we get pool reports from the White House, and the pool reporter was talking about how everyone's dressed up for Halloween in the White House today, and the person who's dressed up as Abraham Lincoln, which is actually a gentleman from Springfield who's playing Abraham Lincoln, the White House reporter went on to explain how many people have said, including past presidents, Jackie Kennedy, all of these people who've said they've seen Abraham Lincoln in the White House, and they've seen his ghost. And there was a whole list of presidents and presidential wives who said they've seen Abraham Lincoln in the White House. But I wanted to ask both of you guys, and Colin, let me start with you. I mean, why are you so fascinated with ghosts?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, you know, what Troy was saying was really resonates with me as well. I mean, I grew up sort of interested, I think, in those things that didn't quite fit sort of normal explanations. And you know, these ghost stories, I think, are a really great way for us to, you know, engage in questions of mortality, engage in questions of the unknown, and, you know, and particularly engage in questions of sort of, you know, history on a very micro level. You know, the great thing about a ghost story is it's usually not, you know, the sort of great history of America. It's the history of, you know, a house or a hotel or a cemetery or even, you know, a grave marker, you know, the famous Inez Clark statue in Graceland Cemetery, which is haunted. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of just sort of little micro histories that ghost stories kind of reach out to. And I think that's a really fascinating way of looking at the country, sort of less about, you know, famous presidents and major battles and more about these little tiny places that need as much of a history as anything else.
Well, and so let's talk about some of those places, because Colin, we mentioned Bull Valley in northern Illinois. Troy, you talked about Resurrection Mary and that story on the south side of Chicago, well, a little further south of the city also, it sounded like. Troy, what are some other spots that you think of when you think of sort of top haunted spots in Illinois?
Well, some of my favorite spots, there's the Lincoln Theater in Decatur, Illinois, is an old vaudeville theater, just turned 100 years old, I think, yesterday. And it's one of those places where, you know, people have come for years and claim that they've had encounters with something spectral inside the building. There's a church down in Alton, Illinois, that's haunted.
Sorry,
where
did you say, sorry?
In Alton, Illinois,
okay.
Down along
mm-hmm.
the Mississippi, yeah, and it and it's not. I mean, Alton's one of those towns that's got this great history of all this Civil War history, these horrific things that have happened there over the years. But there's this one building that I consider to be the most haunted building in town, and it's a minister actually committed suicide in 1936 in the building, and you know, the parishioners have believed that he's never left, that his ghost has been there all along.
Oh, so you give tours, but, right? You give tours at the Lincoln Theater, and you have in Alton as well.
Yeah, I've got tours all over the state.
And what do you do? How do you do that? Do you go in? Do you tell the story? What happens?
Well, all of the tours are usually based on history. And they're history tours that have ghost stories attached to them, because history is the most important thing to me. I mean, that's the reason why I've stayed with this as long as I have, because I think that most supernatural events that people report or encounter, I think, can be explained by history. I think that events, especially traumatic or violent events, sort of leave an impression behind on a place. I guess just sort of a lingering bit of history that, you know, we think of it as a haunting, you know, sights, sounds, things that people can't explain. And you know, if you're in the right place at the right time, well, maybe you'll experience it yourself. And that's kind of the idea behind the tours, is to take people to places where there's a great history behind it. And there are ghost stories attached to it, too. We don't ever tell people that we're going to take them to some place and we guarantee that ghosts are going to, you know, come out and perform on command or anything.
Right.
Like
you guys
that.
Are not it's ghost not, hunters. This is not sci-fi ghost hunters, right? You're not going in there with instruments and measuring things.
Right. No. And yeah, that kind of thing has not really ever interested me that much. I don't know how you would ever really prove anything.
Yeah. Colin, how about you? Stuff. That's not something I imagine. Doesn't sound like that's something you do either, right?
You know, I did it a couple of times for the book. I went to the Lemp Mansion in St. Louis, Missouri, and took a ghost tour involving a infrared camera looking for spirits, and yeah, the results were inconclusive. But you know, I think it is a kind of you know, it's another sort of fascinating way to kind of try to reach out and touch something maybe a little larger than yourself. And I think that can be kind of fascinating in its own right, even if occasionally it's a little hokey.
Well, and let me ask you guys both of this. Is we have a couple minutes to wrap up, but I think this is kind of the important last question for both of you, right? And Colin, let's start with you. I think some people love visiting haunted places, especially this time of year. Others would prefer to not entertain the idea that ghosts may be real. And I'm wondering where each of you stand personally about what you believe about this. Colin?
I think that we're kind of told that there are kind of two different answers to that question, that either you are a 100% believer in ghosts or you are a 100% skeptic, rational person. And when I was interviewing people and talking to people about ghosts, what I found again and again is that most of us are somewhere in between. And I guess I'd put myself in that category. I mean, I met so many people who, you know, they don't believe in ghosts, but they've seen something they can't explain, or, you know, or maybe they do, but they've found a way to explain away everything they've ever possibly seen. And I think that's kind of a more interesting place to be, in that kind of ambiguous sort of middle ground.
Troy, what about you?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that for me personally, and this is just my personal belief, I believe there's something after this, not necessarily in a religious sense, but maybe in a spiritual one. And I do believe in ghosts just because of some of the personal experiences I've had. Now, I don't go around trying to convince other people they need to believe. And I believe that most hauntings are just like what I described, just sort of a lingering history. But I do think that there are cases out there where there are spirits who their personality stays behind for whatever reason. And I've had enough experiences in doing this for, you know, 25 years that I feel like that's something that has convinced me. But most of the time I'd have to agree with Colin and call myself optimistically skeptical. I go to places where I'd like to believe it's haunted, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, but the stories or the, you know, the facts, you don't really necessarily mean much of anything. They don't agree with the stories or whatever. So it's just, I think of it as a lot of fun, and I'm lucky to get to do what I do.
And so that said, that said, what's the strangest phenomenon you've ever encountered, Troy, here in Illinois?
I went to a woman's house. This has been years ago. And to keep the story short, she claimed that all of these things were happening, that there were, you know, things moving around and there were footsteps and noises and everything. And this is before I stopped going to people's houses because I found that the living are much scarier than the dead. But in this particular case, I will tell you that we were all sitting in the living room and actually heard someone running back and forth. I mean, running, pounding back and forth in the hallway upstairs. They were so afraid of the upstairs that they kept it locked. They didn't even go up there. There was so much noise. So we unlocked the door. I ran up there. I searched the floor. There's absolutely no one there. And I can't explain it. Couldn't explain it then. Can't explain it now. But it was unnerving. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think you've unnerved all of us now. All right. That's Troy Taylor. He's the author of Haunted Illinois, Ghosts and Strange Phenomena of the Prairie State. As you heard, he gives lots of tours throughout Illinois. I want to thank also Colin Dickey. His new book is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate you sharing your stories.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. At the top of the hour, we talked about Senator Mark Kirk's racist comments he made last night about Representative Tammy Duckworth's family during their debate televised last night. From his official campaign account, Senator Kirk has just tweeted out an apology for what he said about her family. He said, and I quote, "Sincere apologies to an American hero, Tammy Duckworth, and gratitude for her family's service." Stay tuned to your newscast this afternoon and this evening. I'm sure we'll continue to follow that story for you. You're listening to The 21st.
Because this is how we bring in the sun. This is how we bring in the sun. This is how we tell everyone. This is how we bring in the sun. We'll build a secret fort where we'll hold court under the cushions. Then we can tear that sucker down.
That's Chicago musician Justin Roberts. He's a Grammy-nominated artist for his children's music. His latest album is called Lemonade. It just came out earlier this month. Last week, it charted on Billboard's Kids Album Chart. Justin's on the line with us from Chicago. Hey, Justin, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, Nyla. So glad to.
So how's the response been to this album so far?
It's been pretty fantastic. You know, it's a little different than the last couple that I've made that have been much more like giant rock records. And this one was done kind of live in the studio with some different musicians that I normally work with. And I've been getting great feedback. You know, I never know what people are going to like when I'm writing for kids and families. So it's been fun to hear the responses.
Well, and I should point out, and this is an important distinction I think that you always like to make, that it's kids' music. We're going to put kids in quotes, really only in its lyrical content. And why is that important for you as you're working on your music?
I guess because I'm a music fan myself. And, you know, I got started doing this in the early 90s when I was working as a preschool teacher just out of college. And I loved music, and I, you know, listened to a lot of different types of music, and I started playing different songs for kids and just realized that they, you know, had a wide array of things that they would like and enjoy, from anything from punk rock to Sam Cooke songs. And so when I started writing songs for them, I just sort of wrote what I thought was good music that had some good hooks, and they liked it. And that was kind of the beginning.
Well, and I think you often hear from parents, right, who say to you, thanks for making kids music that's enjoyable and not super annoying, right?
Yeah, and also just like I listen after I drop my kids off at school and continue listening to the record. And, you know, I love most of all probably when parents share with me moments where they hear something in a song and they're like, oh my gosh, that just totally brought back a memory of my childhood that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And, you know, that sort of thing. So when it's working on both levels for the kids and the adults and they can enjoy it together, that's kind of the goal.
Well, and as you say that, I wonder if we can play one of your songs. This is called Must Be This Tall, because I think there's a couple moments in this, and obviously I'm a really short person, so I think I've always been like, this has always been something that personally I always remember, even as an adult, I'm one of the shortest people in the room. But let's take a listen to this song and then we can talk about it. Okay, this is Must Be This Tall. It's from Justin Roberts' new album, Lemonade.
Stood in the very same line, must be this tall to ride. Double crossing my fingers, gonna straighten my spine, must be this tall to ride. This year is gonna be different, this year is gonna be fine. My heart skips a beat, a little shaky inside, must be this tall to ride. Straight with a comb, must be this tall to ride. Measured over 47 inches at home, must be this tall to ride. To see that wooden man with his outstretched hand. I told my mama wasn't scared, but I kinda lied. Must be this tall to ride. Jumping house, we jumped. it, but I almost cried. Must be this tall to ride, to ride. Must be this tall to ride. Get in that seat and the bar comes down. Must be this tall to ride. There won't be no more turning around. Must be this tall to ride.
This must be this tall off of Justin Roberts' latest album. It's called Lemonade. Hey, Justin, so there's a couple things I want to ask you about that song. I'll get to the music in a second, but let's start with the message, because I think that is what we were talking about, right? About how they're sort of relatable across ages. I will say you're a pretty tall guy. So I feel like, did you really have this problem when you were a kid? Did you have a growth spurt after I met you? Because you're tall.
Well, I did have an older brother who's 3 years older. So I think I had maybe the experience of sometimes not being tall enough, or, you know, watching him and his friends play basketball or something and not being able to do it quite the same. But I didn't have the experience of, you know, being short my whole life, which I've talked to people about after having written
right,
the song
yeah.
and have shared those stories with me.
But do you think, I wonder if there's the thing about it is there's sort of a message that I think is relatable across all ages, right? Like if you're good enough for something, right? And do you think, I wonder how much adults maybe take that message to heart more when they hear it from a kid's perspective?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, it's been fun. We played that song pretty early on live before the record was out. And that was one where, you know, we played it and then we played all the songs that people already knew, and kids would come up and say that was their favorite song and what record was it on. And I was like, wow, so kids get it. I mean, that, you know, I never know if it's going to work on that level, but from an adult perspective, like, it worked when I was writing it. It felt emotional to me, and it felt like, even though I can't totally relate to how it feels to be short all your life, sorry, Nyla.
Right, yeah.
You know, the idea of like, this year is going to be different. Maybe I can do it this time. You know, that sort of thing resonated with me.
And so how do you, I wonder, can you take me a little bit into the thought process of how you write your, like with this song, where did it come from, the idea to do this?
Well, the funny thing is, I think sometimes the best ideas I have come from other people, which is the case of this song. I got a text message from one of my friends whose child used to listen to my music a long time ago and who's now probably 17 or 18. And she said, have you ever written a song about trying to ride the roller coaster and wondering if you're tall enough? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's an excellent idea. And so I started, I just started sort of singing. Well, first thing I did was Googled the sign and like, it's like, oh yeah, it must be this tall to ride. And then I was like, I wonder how tall you have to be on a roller coaster generally. And like, just sort of got some facts. And then I started writing various versions of the song. I think I wrote like four different melodies, and some of them were a little bit more like a pop song. And then I kind of settled on this kind of old folk music style of having the chorus repeat the words a lot, because I thought it would be good for singing along. And
it's a little twangier.
You know,
it's interesting too, because it's like, I feel like
yeah.
it's a little twangier than your usual music, like they're than previous albums. So that's kind
yeah.
of a different place you're in with this album than you were before.
Yeah, and I think part of it was I started this record thinking I'm going to make a simpler record with less chords and acoustic instruments and record it live in the studio. And, you know, eventually we decided on the musicians and came up with Robbie Foulkes on acoustic guitar and vocals on that last one, and John Abbey playing upright bass, and our drummer playing like cardboard boxes and strange percussion items. And once I sort of knew that that was happening, or even began the record with that in mind, I started writing in that way and stopping myself if I got too complicated or got too much like a rock song.
Yeah, and you recorded this live also. So how was it recording everything at the same time? Did that feel better? Because, and it's interesting because so much of your performances are live in front of audiences too.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I like doing it both ways. But the thing that was great about this experience was playing with some musicians I don't play with very often. There were just moments in each take that were like, wow, that was magic that happened. And that was so cool. And like, there are times where I can actually hear myself smiling when I'm singing, because I was listening to something that was going on in the room. And, you know, that sort of thing, I think, is exciting for people to hear. And it was exciting for us to record that way.
And as you say that, with how you're trying to keep it simple, I think you use a lot of everyday items, whether you're using cardboard boxes or paint cans or how do kids react when they see someone using that at a live show?
That was really fun, because we actually just did a CD release show at Space up in Evanston 2 weeks ago. And Gerald brought the kit that he played in on the record, with literally a cardboard box over his snare and all these funny various things that he would hit during the show. And I watched kids watch him during the concert and just were like glued to him. And before the show, kids were wandering on stage and Gerald kind of showed them some of the stuff that he was playing. And I think they respond to that. I like having a variety of instruments on the record in addition to the acoustic guitar, banjo, upright bass and drums. There's, you know, cellos and harpsichords and violas and fiddles and a bunch of different things. So, you know, it has a variety of sounds, even though there's not a lot of amps and electronic instruments.
Justin,
other records.
You know, we had the hip hop classical duo Black Violin on the show a couple weeks ago, and they told us about kids moshing at their shows. They had like kiddie mosh pits. Do you have kiddie mosh pits? What's the reaction from kids at your show?
We do. It's super fun. I mean, that's the thing that I discovered early on about kids, is that they're the most honest audience you can have, and so they will just jump up and start dancing without worrying about who's around them and whether people are looking at them like some adults might. And, you know, if they're bored, they'll walk away and say, "Mom, I want to go home." So you have to really
be on your
best to make sure that you're performing at a level that keeps them engaged, which, you know, part of that element is just keeping it really interactive in the concert. And, you know, sometimes, like with Must Be This Tall to Ride, I think about that when I'm writing the song. I'm like, well, this is going to work well because it says the same lyrics over and over and the audience can sing that. I can sing the other stuff. But other times I write the song first and then try to figure out how we're going to keep people engaged during the show. So it's fun both ways.
Well, listen, Justin, thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. Let's end
glad
by
to
listening to the title track. So Justin Roberts' latest album is called Lemonade, and this is the title track, Chicago-based Justin Roberts. Justin, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla. I'm glad to be here.
It was the hottest day in July. We were sweaty on the porch, just my brother and I. My dad said, "Boys, when we were young, this is the way we lived when the heat just stung. We'd mix the sweet with the sour, we could just sit there for hours, with the ice and the lemon and the sugar in the shade. We were all grown up. Lemonade."
That does it for us this week. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, is on our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great weekend. Go Cubs. We'll be back here on Monday.
Lemonade. It was the hottest day in July.
Had to be the hottest day.
The air was thick, not a cloud in the sky.
Had to be the hottest day.
And when I called out to my dog.